Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to have one horse discussion because I'm getting laryngitis again.
and the good news, listeners, is we have not yet found a way to transmit cold germs over the internet. although I'm sure somebody's working on it.
Yeah, I'm sure too.
Anyway, it's a sort of a mixed bag today, but it's really some pretty special stuff. I mean, here's the thing. There are a lot of huge soccer fans in the United States, but the national soccer team didn't make it to the finals of the World Cup. Now, we're talking first off about a man who steered the U.S. team to win the Paul Bocuse d'Or award, which is even more unlikely than the U.S. winning the World Cup. It's an amazing, amazing story, together with also being a very fine cookbook.
Yes, and it's an accomplishment in that you'll find this hard to believe, that a food competition could become a page-turner, but it is that, too.
Well, Philip Tessier, I'm telling you, you wrote a thriller instead of a cookbook. I've had such anxiety attacks reading about your competition. The book is, of course, Chasing Bocuse, America's Journey to the Culinary World Stage, and it's full of tensions. Of course, the competition is, right?
Yeah, most definitely. You need to live in the real story there.
It's a good job we know what the answer is, otherwise Anne wouldn't be able to stand it.
Right. Spoiler alert on the ending.
Listeners, in case you're not American and you're listening and you're wondering what's going on, in this country everybody loves a winner. In my native land, sore losers are admired. good fellows who say, but it's only a game.
Right.
It's a whole lot more than that. And tell us why that is, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think our culture is unique in a certain way. I think it's interesting. Like, we don't really pay attention to things that we're not winning to a large degree. I think if you look at American soccer, for example, it's kind of been that story, especially with, like, the women's soccer. And it wasn't until they won, you know, the gold in the World Cup that things totally changed. And, you know, 8 years later, everyone's, you know, paying attention to it. I've always kind of jokingly said that, you know, there's the two things we need to do with this specific competition, and that is to win, and then, you know, the second one is to make it entertaining. We have a nation that's obsessed with food entertainment, and,
right,
you know, as you've read in the book already, you know, there's so much inherent entertainment in the sense of just the tension and the drive and the characters involved, that it's something that really is a great opportunity for us to kind of package us in a way that the American audience and, you know, supporters and fans and chefs across the country can really engage with. And it's really the main purpose for the book, was to kind of put that story in people's hands and get them excited and engaged with what we've done and what we continue to do.
And the funny part about it is I was sure what you would say is repeat. do it a second time.
Yeah, definitely pursuing the dynasty, you know, of our, you know, it wasn't this one thing we did once, but the continuous being one of the leading contenders for being on that podium and winning gold for sure is one of our top goals.
Well, Philip, set the stage for people who may not know. I mean, I never understood why, with all the talent involved with this, why Americans never won anything in this competition, mm-hmm, until the great chef Paul Bocuse, who the competition Bocuse d'Or is named after, until he asked Thomas Keller and Daniel Ballou to help America get organized for this. And by the way, your note in this book is the first time I understood why he was so hell-bent on getting America into a winning mode. His, mm-hmm, his affiliation through a blood transfusion in World War II. And that's why,
yeah,
he was
really
interested.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a great story. I mean, he was fighting for the resistance in World War II and was injured and received GI blood transfusion in a GI hospital there, and basically saved his life. And so, in a sense, he's always said that he has American blood running through his veins. And, you know, he flies an American flag over, his restaurant every day, and you know, he has a real affection for America and what we've done for his country, and so there's always been that kind of natural affection for the U.S. And so I think, you know, in 2008 when he approached Chef Keller and Danielle, it was really like, you've seen the transformation of cuisine and food in the country. You know, why isn't that traveling here? We need a better structure there to help bring that same level of quality to the Boku store that we've seen in the restaurants across the country.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be one, for some reason, I never understood why the Scandinavians wanted, except for, you know, the French. I mean, I can understand the French. But I've eaten a lot of Scandinavian food, and this has been going on a long time before the Danish invasion and the, you know, I mean, it's long-standing. Their dominance, why?
Yeah, you know, I've spent a lot of time actually with the Scandinavian teams. I was just in Sweden helping to judge their national selection in September, and 2 years ago I was in Norway. And the interesting thing is, this is a highly revered competition over there. You know, in Norway, if you even just compete in the Boku store, you're a national celebrity. And Orion, who, you know, took gold in 2015 alongside me, like, when I went to go visit him, he's driving a sponsored car. There's a sponsor helping to build a home for him. You know, it's really the pinnacle of chefdom, if you will, in Norway. And so they put just an incredible amount of importance on it, and they've built a kind of mind-blowing approach to how they train for this, from bringing young kids in through young chefs competitions they do, getting them involved in the Boku store selections at a young age. And then, you know, the great thing is the candidates who compete, the ones who, you know, maybe take second, third, fourth, whatever place they take, they continue to work alongside that new team and then come back again to compete again 2 years later for the opportunity to do it themselves. So the chance of anyone competing for Norway, for example, at the Boku store without having been alongside that organization, going to the Boku store, possibly competing as a Komi previously is absolute zero. And they put the time and effort into it, and you know, that's really what you're up against when you're looking at, you know, training for this and preparing for this. If you want to win, if you want to be at the same level as these other countries, that, you know, some of them have national support. You know, the Crown Prince of Norway is at the competition, their national selection, and not just attending, but sitting in with the judges and talking about the competition and asking questions. And, you know, there's just a whole level of importance placed on this that is, you know, something that has grown there in the last 15 years.
Well, you actually, for a long time, I mean, even when did it start? When we had the mentor with them? Where the foundation actually started picking up expenses. Everybody else was on their own, right?
Yeah, you were largely responsible. I mean, I think Gavin Kaysen in 2007 was really the kind of one of the spurring factors in getting the mentor organization formed, which is, again, the organization that oversees the Boku Store USA and support for them. But he was really on his own to find his own funding, find the time to train, you know, getting sponsors and everything, and then all of the effort that goes into the logistics of getting over there and setting everything up, essentially a one-man band trying to make it all happen. And, you know, you're up against these national organizations in the other countries. It's, you know, the chance of us winning at that with that approach is pretty much zero. So the ability for us now to have a structure where candidates are actually literally your full-time job now. You know, it's to train for this competition for a year.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you did physical training, you studied the competition, what went down over the years as successful, what didn't, and physically training. I laughed the story about you with your commie.
With Skyler, yeah.
Yeah, with Skyler. I mean, you tell us about that. What is this position, your commie, your partner in this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really one of the largest challenges, especially in this country, that we have is the way this competition is structured is, you know, you're given 5.5 hours, and it's, you know, you're putting up 14 of a plated dish and 14 of a platter presentation that then's presented on a plated dish for the judges. And so, you know, you have 130 ingredients we used on our two plates, if you will, and the only thing that you have in the kitchen is four burners and one oven. and your partner for this whole competition is a commis or apprentice, and the rules state that they have to be 22 or under at the time of the competition. So if you think of the generation gap between, you know, someone like myself, I think it was 35 at the time, and, you know, a 21, 22-year-old kid, it's quite significant. And thinking about that day, 50% of everything you're going to do is going to fall on the backs of a 22-year-old is pretty stressful.
and scholar.
Yeah, you know, and that's the great thing about the book and the stories. You know, these are just the stories you never get. You know, you just see, oh, they went gold, isn't that great? And everybody, you know, kind of celebrates and moves on. But, you know, behind the scenes is all of those things that you get, you know, when you're leading up to the Olympics and all of those backstories of all the challenges you went to get there. And so when you're there about ready to compete, it's so much more engaging when you've lived that experience. And, you know, Skyler and Harrison, who was the commis this year, you know, both went through very similar things in the sense of how they, you know, kind of confronted the challenges of training for this, the rigors of it, the stress and pressure. You know, you have so many expectations from fairly significant people resting on your shoulders, not to mention the hopes of your own country. So it's really about, you know, that mentoring process through working together. And, you know, there's a lot of lessons that I learned, you know, on not giving up on not just the training process itself, but on the people involved and how we can grow and how do you motivate people and how do you get through just super difficult times in failure. So it's a pretty dramatic story between the layers of everything that we went through as a training process and competing.
Let's be sure to point out that you don't exactly work on home soil. You actually have to do the cooking where the competition is that in Lyon?
Yeah,
so every year it takes place in Lyon, France. So, you know, contrary to the Olympics where it's, you know, in a different location every year, it's always in the same place in Lyon. So that's, you know, definitely one of the logistical challenges. You know, there's a whole story in the book of how all our stuff got stuck in customs, you know, for 3 days.
Yeah, Thomas is kind of used to that. It happened to him all the time.
Yeah, it actually happened to him on the same trip. They were doing a dinner afterwards at the embassy there. So this year, you know, learning from those mistakes, I think that was, you know, people ask, what was the difference from 1 year to the other? And it was like, well, you know, first of all, we were only 9 points out of 2000 away from gold in 2015. But the main thing really is just we were building on a foundation of experience and success that we'd never had before. And, you know, the logistics that we had, the support we had was just, you know, totally different. The ability to get Matt Peters, who is our candidate this year, to kind of just focus primarily on the food with limited amount of challenges on all the other logistics of the shipping company that we were able to get involved and where we're staying and what cars we're driving and, you know, how we're going to get the equipment over there and different things. It was really, you know, able to kind of focus primarily on the food, the structure of the competing and the team and that kind of thing. So there was a large level of support that we've seen kind of just continue to increase year over year. Now we're positioned, you know, really well to kind of continue that growth and build on making this, you know, a permanent position for us as a U.S. to be a main contender.
Now, this, listeners, you got to buy this book just to look at the food and drool, because this is, I mean, it is American food because it was created under the supervision of Thomas Keller, who's very American, and Daniel Ballou, who's made himself very American. But this food is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So incredibly beautiful. Where did that come from, your mentors, or did it just come because all of a sudden you got it together and realized what it would take to win?
This is a good place to introduce the role of Kastner in this.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the food, the main thing that's important about the food is the food really needs to be the candidate's food, right? So, you know, we don't sit down and everybody puts a bunch of ideas down and then the candidate goes off and tries to do them. You know, it's basically the candidate comes forward and says, this is something I'm really excited about. This is a garnish, you know, that I really want to do. Or, you know, we go through a process of discussion of, you know, one tasting and how we want to maybe evolve from there. So, you know, when you look at the food, like a lot of it's, you know, kind of intimidating in the way it's put together, but they're really just a lot of the basic recipes we use in the restaurant, and we've just had the time and resources to be able to bring a level of finesse to them that we've never had before. And you know, as Ann mentioned, Mark Kastner is the, owner and guru behind Crucial Detail of, the design company in Chicago. Most people probably would know him for his work with Alinea and, you know, all of the bacon on wires and pillows with lavender and everything else that are kind of the, you know, toys, if you will, of that restaurant. Martin came alongside us to design our platter for the meat presentation, and through our process of working together, we really kind of found a common language that allowed us to not only build just a platter, but to design the food together and tools and things for it. So, you know, it's all pretty well documented and displayed in the book, and it really just gave us an ability to find a unique level of precision as well as efficiency. A lot of these things are just, and this would be great to do, but this takes, 45 minutes for one. and we need to do 16 of them in 10 minutes. And so Martin and the team were really able just to work on all of those challenges. And, you know, that was a process we went through discovering in 2015 and coming into 2017, I was really excited about all of the groundwork that already been laid and our ability to build on that. But food is really, the work of the candidates and, the coaches and everybody involved helped to kind of guide that process along, especially when it comes to taste and refinement. But, it is really a team effort.
Can you pick a couple of the dishes that you presented that you think maybe these were the ones that were the real winners?
Well, let's first of all say that there are recipes for dishes attached to the book.
Yeah,
but there are different varieties. They have dishes from the competition that you're asking him to pick out of. They also have dishes from the people in this mentor group, like Daniel Ballou and Thomas Keller. And they have dishes from Bocuse, right?
Yeah, so the way we structured the recipes is, I really wanted to obviously include the Bocuse d'Or recipes, at least some of them, because it gives you a better sense of, what goes into this and what all of the challenges are. The number of ingredients, the process of each one, and the detail that we go through. And you get that, I think, through reading those recipes. And then the second part of the recipes is really giving people access to our journey at home. So whether it was staff meals that we cooked, or whether it was classics that we experienced in Lyon, or some of the things from the competition actually that you can do at home, whether it be the brown butter sauce or duck confit. And then the other section is really recipes from all the chefs who've been involved, who are part of the coaching team or the mentor organization, Chef Keller, Balut, Kevin, Richard Rosendale.
People
who competed in 2013. So it was really, the goal for the book was to make it, as much as we could, a group story, America story. And you see all the excerpts throughout the book from all of the different coaches and, teammates who were involved. But I think some of the key, recipes, as you had originally asked, was, some of the things that kind of represented our country in a unique way. And that's part of your challenge, is how well you represent your country. I think one of my personal favorites is just the corn nest that we did in 2015. That was, a pursuit of corn, if you will, as an ingredient that's really kind of very American in a lot of ways, and kind of an ingredient that isn't used heavily over there. And if it is, it's kind of disguised in many ways.
Yes.
You don't see fresh corn on the cob, over in Europe very often.
No, yeah.
And so
I don't think I ever have. I'm trying to think. I've never seen it.
And if you have, it's probably for an American wedding of some kind. but, that was really a pursuit of that ingredient. Corn puree is something that's just amazingly delicious. How do we take that and put it in a form and, allow that to kind of still have that amazing flavor come through? The corn silk that we did, I think, was just a lot of fun. Taking something that, normally gets scattered on the floor in the process of shucking and turn that into just a really unique and delicious, way of eating that product. So I think when you look at the pursuit of that, it's really kind of sums up the Bocuse d'Or in a sense of it's a pursuit of excellence. It's really, how do I make things taste as amazing as possible? My biggest critics were my kids. They would come in at the end of a training run and I'd have them taste everything, and kids will be straight honest with you, but I would know when they would go and start eating these like potato chips that we were on the right track.
I'm right.
That was kind of a fun way of doing it. And then, you know, where Martin really kind of came in was helping to build the precision, and then also how do we present this? You know, we can't put these little corn eggs that we've made on top of these nests, or they're going to get soggy, and like, how do we have that present on the platter? And kind of the genius way that was suspended over the center of it was really fun.
I often wondered, because, you know, I've eaten at Alinea, and I often wondered, I mean, does Martin cook? I mean, does he know about, I mean, because it seems like he knows more about food than somebody his métier would know.
I mean, Martin is just a unique mind in so many ways. I think he really loves food. He has a great understanding of it. In fact, when he first met Grant, I think it was that true, and kind of gave him a hard time about the structure of his menu. And I think the thing that we discovered, like when you meet Martin for the very first time and you start to have a conversation, you quickly realize, okay, this guy just sees the world differently, right? So, like, I see this as, you know, colors and a texture and a flavor, and he sees it as just a totally different medium. And he applies all that he knows, you know, from his background of art and being a blacksmith and being, you know, an engineer, and turns that into this whole creative process. And so what we really found was, like, we were both kind of chefs in a kitchen, in a sense, but my tools and ingredients and his tools and ingredients were just different, even though we were playing with the same thing in the end. And so, like, his understanding of food and form is just such a central piece of what he would constantly challenge me, and then, you know, I would constantly challenge him, and it just became this really unique relationship and friendship that we've built over the last 4 years of doing this together.
Now, once you've participated, you don't get to do it the next year, do you?
So you do have the option of coming back and compete again. You know, in fact, Rasmus Kofed, who has a 3 Michelin star restaurant, Geranium, in Copenhagen, he competed for bronze, silver, took a year off, and then came back and competed for gold. And so that is an option. In fact, you know, after 2015 and being so close to gold, obviously the temptation to come back and come back and finish that job myself was there. But I really wanted to build more than just the next team, and winning gold. I wanted to build the team and the future and the kind of structure of how we could grow. And so, you know, the key thing for me was, like, if we find candidates who are strong enough to compete and come back and win gold, then I would take on the position of coach as opposed to competing myself. So that was really kind of my, you know, my choice to come back and coach the team and give everything back that we had done in 2015 and put all of that into the next team. So, you know, you can come back and do it again. It's still an option.
I see. But you didn't. And you did, well, of course, you had a kind of move on anyhow, didn't you? I mean, you did you give up your position at the French Laundry?
Yeah, so, I mean, we had kind of had an understanding, like, as I pursued the competition, you know, from that point, right, I would move on from the restaurant. And so, you know, it was kind of a good transition time for me. It was also a good opportunity to kind of invest in the next team, and then the book kind of came along as well. So, you know, there was a lot on my docket that I wanted to achieve. And I knew that if I had my head down on the cutting board trying to pursue those last 9 points, you know, that it would limit, like, what we would be able to do to increase the awareness of the competition and the investment of other chefs in the competition itself. So
you mentioned something in the book that I think that it's very true, and very few people really think about it or realize it, is that there are chefs that are really focused on competition as opposed to chefs who are focused on, say, the business of a restaurant or a particular, you know, a food aspect of their cooking style and repertoire. And I mean, I've known chefs that are, in fact, I wrote a cookbook with one that was really mainly in competition. You were not, and you went cold into this, which was an amazing learning process for you.
It's always been this kind of divide between, you know, okay, here's the competition chefs, and here's, you know, let's say the Michelin star chefs. It's different in Europe, you know, that's less of the case. And here, you know, I think for me in this competition, like, I had never competed since, like, culinary school and some small competitions I did then. And, you know, it's pretty intimidating. You know, you're there. We've never won. We've never done better than sixth. We've never been on the podium. Here you are going to compete against a guy who's already won silver, another guy who's in his third Bocuse d'Or, you know, two other guys who are coming back who've placed in the top 10 before. And Skyler and I are going in to compete like we've never competed together ever. And so, you know, it was kind of just putting all of your confidence in the training there. You know, obviously that we had an amazing and successful run, but I don't think that's the template we want moving forward. You know, certainly like now our goal is to really kind of engage in, you know, I'm hoping with the book that we're able to do that, to really engage, you know, a younger group of chefs who are able to kind of begin planning, you know, their careers and having the opportunities down the road kind of slated for this, where...
Well, the book is a great read, and I think it's going to be a success. Just I'm big on wrapping things. And so you are doing what now? Because that was kind of interesting, too. You were doing something totally different.
After I competed in 2015, you know, the goal for me was to open a restaurant. But I didn't want to open a restaurant and try to coach the team. There was just going to be too much that I wanted to invest in the team that opening a restaurant wouldn't allow. And so I found a really great opportunity working with a new company called Heston Smart Cooking that actually kind of helped to form over the next 6 months after competing. And over the last 2.5 years, we've built, you know, a pretty amazing Bluetooth-enabled cooking system with temperature control, controlled by an app. And really the whole goal for me is to bring people back into the kitchen cooking again. So I've been working on that, and, you know, the goal now after the competition's been over and the book is out, is to really get back to working on my own restaurant, probably here in Napa Valley. So that's kind of the next step.
Oh, okay. So you're going to go back to restaurant cook.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is to hopefully continue the path that I'm on here with, you know, all the innovation we've been able to achieve with Heston, and then, you know, continue moving on into the restaurant and looking at opening something probably early 2019.
Well,
listen, Philip Tessier, your country is very proud of you.
Yes.
The country is proud of you. It's proud of your commis, Skylar. And they said it couldn't be done, and you did it. So well done, well done, well done.
Thank you very much. Yeah, there's very few things like representing your country on the world stage.
Right.
It's an amazing honor.
Thanks, Philip.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back with conversation with an old friend who, after hundreds of years of television, finally wrote a book.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I don't know how many people know that the very first public broadcasting system in the country was actually in Pittsburgh, and it's WQED. Now, our next guest has been the chef for QED Cooks for his whole career, and also is a colleague of mine writing for Pittsburgh Magazine. He finally produced a cookbook called Simple Pleasures, which gets, well, you're going to enjoy seeing this. You listen to our conversation, and you will really enjoy finding old favorites that you let slip from your mind in this book. Now, this book is called Simple Pleasures, and Chris Fenimore might want you to believe he's a simple guy, but let me tell you, I've known him since the early 1990s, and he is not as simple as you would want to think, except in his taste in food. He likes real food. And that's the subtitle of this book, Recipes and Memories of Real Food. And you did, Chris, this book with Daniel Aguera?
Yes, Daniel actually had posted a picture on Facebook of a dish that his grandma used to make him. It was a very beautiful picture, and it had rice with tomato sauce on it and a fried egg.
Oh, it's in this book, yes.
It is in this book. Yes. And I wrote back to him, and I said, Daniel, I think you're onto something. This world is ready for simple pleasures like the ones that you and I both enjoyed from our grandmothers. Both Daniel and I actually grew up in the households of our grandmothers, and so it was heavily influenced by the ethnic recipes and by this sort of a simple attitude towards good ingredients. You have to start with great ingredients and then do as little as possible.
Yes, exactly.
Keep it simple, you know who. And because I have been looking at, you know, I don't watch much cable food show, and but they glorify this sort of hyper cooking techniques and crazy ingredients and crazy utensils, and everything is more complicated than the thing before, and you have to have emulsified nettle fronds.
Oh, I thought that was funny. You put that in your introduction.
Because that's what you'll see, and now you see that on the menus of a lot of restaurants. And I'm not knocking restaurants who want to do that. I think that there are a lot of chefs out there who this is how they get off. They want to put 14 flavors in your mouth at once and see how you like it, which is fine, because you make the choice whether to go to that restaurant or not. But I'm just saying, for the most of us, we're not going to have access to those ingredients, and we're not going to have access to the kinds of procedures that produce those gastriques and foams and whatnots that they put on the plate in order to complicate the flavors.
But they are going to get Daniel Aguirre and Chris Fenimore's family secrets. Like Sunday sauce. It always amuses me.
Yeah.
This thing called Sunday sauce, and you could call it pasta sauce, but no, everybody calls it Sunday sauce.
Well, that's because there was such a strong tradition of making that sauce every Sunday. For my grandmother, it was a matter of Sunday was the only day. She worked Monday through Friday as a seamstress in New York City.
Oh.
Then on Saturday, she cleaned her house within an inch of its life. I mean, she was one of those people with the toothbrush on the floor, you know, trying to get in the corners. And then on Sunday, she started the Sunday sauce at 8 o'clock in the morning. It took 5 hours to make. So by 1 o'clock, we were ready to sit down to dinner. But that also meant that we had sauce for things for the rest of the week. We had meatballs for the rest of the week, for leftovers, for sandwiches, and so on. And the pasta was often left over because they served so many things on Sunday, in addition to the Sunday sauce and its pasta. So it was an efficient way of using the one day that she had for cooking that was going to take a long time, not that it was very difficult. And there is no secret to this recipe. All the ingredients are things that, you know, if you don't have them in your house, you probably have some version of it. I'm a big believer in the flavor of tomatoes that are, the better kinds of canned tomatoes.
Yes.
San Marzano, in particular, because they have a deeper, more tomato flavor. So all of the recipes that are in here use that better ingredient, as far as I'm concerned. And the results are simple, but more delicious than you would think.
Now, you and Ann are together because you have similar ethnic roots.
Yeah, he and I have done this trip down
memory lane.
Memory lane quite a few times because both our mother's roots were, and grandmother's roots were Sicilian.
Whereas Daniel comes from Asturias.
Co-writer.
A region of northern Spain, which has its own wonderful tradition, particularly of things like chorizo.
Yeah, what about that long stuff? That's not in here. I was hoping to get some of that.
Have you ever met Robin Fernandez?
No, I have not.
Okay.
His roots are there.
His roots were from Asturias, but he found an old lady in Clarksburg, West Virginia, who would make a sausage for him called longo.
That's not quite right.
Or luongo.
I don't know.
And she wouldn't give him the recipe, but she would make him sausage in season.
And he used to get some for us.
and if you tasted it, you'd want to have some too.
Yeah. He used to get some for us and call us. Now, Chris, how did you two, I mean, you shared this, just an attitude about how these foods were so comforting and simple and honest in your childhoods. How did you sort through this? I would love to have sat through some of your meetings on describing or deciding what's going into this book.
I wish that it was as organized as that, Anne. I have to say that what we did was I said, here's a bunch of recipes that I remember, and I sent them to him, and he sent me a list and said, here's a bunch of recipes that I remember, and then I went through them and tried to figure out if they fit into some categories. And so, because there had to be some way to organize this other than our random remembrances of recipes from our childhood. And so the book is not typical in that it doesn't follow a meal from appetizers to desserts, but there is some effort to put things in some kind of order. So we have a whole bunch of bread-related recipes, because a lot of my childhood was about bread. My mother was a great bread baker, pizza maker, Zeppoli maker, biscuit.
Oh yeah, that's what I missed, the Zeppoli. Yeah.
And it turns out that Daniel had a bunch of things in that category as well, like the churros.
Yes, that's true.
That he had to make. So, and then when we got to soup, it was pretty much 50-50. He had a lot of soups, and so did I. Everything from how to make the original chicken brodo, you know, the chicken broth, which my grandmother made. That's the other thing she did on Sunday, is that she always made a chicken broth so that we would have that broth for soups during the week.
Right.
Then we would make pastina if there was a little kid in the house or if somebody was sick. I think my grandmother ate escarole soup 3 nights out of 5.
We still use that. We do chicken soup with escarole.
Oh, my God. Escarole, you know, escarole, as she called it, was a real staple in our house, and she bought it by the basketful and cooked it down, and that's what she had as a preliminary to all of her weekday meals. But then Daniel was able to add things like a harvest soup and a garlic soup, and so there, you know, and a salted cod and garbanzo beans.
Yes, that was good.
Which really looks great and tastes great. We made all of these dishes when we did the photo shoots with Laura Petrilla. We went to Daniel's house and we cooked and cooked and cooked until we ran out of ingredients. And then we ate and ate and ate until we couldn't eat anymore. I would have to say that none of these recipes fell off the table once we cooked and ate them. They were all just as good as we remembered.
Okay. I got the names of some of the things that I remembered. Some of your names are different, but I never knew anything about Davy Crockett toast, but I had that when I was sick, too. The same.
You know, I think my mother just made that name up. I don't know that there was a recipe. But Davy Crockett was so popular at that era. They had made the Walt Disney movie, and, you know, I had my Davy Crockett hat, my coonskin cap with the little raccoon tail. And I had, all the Davy Crockett accoutrements that you could have. And they just wanted me to eat the toast. So they said, oh, this is Davy Crockett toast. Actually, what it is like French toast, but without the dipping. You just cook the bread. It's like fried bread, what it is.
Right. You have fried bread in here. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I think that people are going to discover looking through this is how long it's been since you've had some of these wonderful things. When was the last time you had a baked apple? We used to have them every week.
Yeah, I think a lot of things people have just forgotten about, or they're too young to remember. But in our house, we always had some kind of dessert. Sometimes it was pudding or jello. But in season, we would have baked apples or some fresh applesauce.
Yes.
My mom would take advantage of the fact that the apples at that point would be as cheap as they would ever be. And we ate very frugally. Both my dad and my mom were kids during the Depression.
Yes.
And that never left them. It just didn't.
I heard that my whole childhood. I heard about the Depression.
Yeah, and I walked 5 miles to school. It was uphill both ways.
Yeah, but
and the snow came over my boot tops.
I have to mention one other thing that really sent me back is green beans with tomatoes. We had those all the time.
Isn't that something? And
yes.
It's the simplest thing. But
why in the world don't we eat like that anymore?
And we had it every Sunday as you know, as an accompaniment to chicken or roast beef or whatever we had as the sort of main course after the pasta.
Well, listeners around the world who subscribe to On the Menu's bookshelf or who get their books satisfaction from Amazon.com, here's good news for you. You still have time to buy a copy of this to give to your favorite relative for Christmas.
Oh, yeah. It's a perfect gift for Christmas.
It's called Simple Pleasures by Chris Fenimore, well-loved here in Pittsburgh and should be better known around the world, and Daniel O'Gara, who comes from Spain but is now famous here in the city of champions.
Now, I'm going to say one thing, is that I have been not only a colleague, but I've been out and about with Chris Fenimore. And, Chris, I think this book is going to do very well because you have so many people who love you. And your cooking show is so popular, and I think people are going to want to be able to explore with you some of these little niches in our family histories of food.
Yeah, I've been lucky to be able to reach into the community over the last 24 years with a weekly program that connects us directly to people, and they've been generous in sharing their family traditions with us. So I've picked up a few little tips here and there, and people have been very generous about saying that they picked up things. And I love when people tell me, for instance, that they watch the program with an elderly mother, grandmother, or aunt, because cooking also is something that crosses generations. And I have this image in my mind of people getting this book, Simple Pleasures, and making recipes with somebody older who lived through these recipes when, you know, they were normally around, and sharing the stories around them in their lives. So that's my sort of fantasy about how people will use this book.
Well, Chris, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it, and much luck with it, and I think you're going to have a lot of success with it.
Well, I hope that people will enjoy it.
I think that they will. Thanks, Chris.
All right, Ann, thank you. Bye, Peter.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
About our next guest, Andrew Freeman, is that he has a website, and on that website he puts up there practically everything he knows. Practically everything he knows about trends in the food and hospitality business is on his website. Now, I think he can be a client and get more in-depth services, but you're going to find out a lot about what Andrew Freeman, a real expert, thinks is in your future when it comes to food.
I just asked Andrew Freeman, how long has this been going on? Because it seems to me I've been reading the Freeman Report on food and restaurant trends for as long as I can remember.
Hi everybody, this is Andrew Freeman, and it has been going on for a long time. It's our company is 12 years old this year, and the trend report is 10 years old.
Okay.
Now, it's really funny, listeners. Be sure to make note, you're in the presence of a real expert. I know, because the list of questions we're going to be able to ask him covers at least four pages.
Oh, gosh. Okay. We're going to be here all day. Okay.
we might have to have you pick and choose.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Who gets this report?
So the report goes that, you know, basically, well, the report is on our website, so anybody who's interested in food and beverage trends, you know, or hotel trends or marketing trends, anything related to the hospitality industry, the trend report is available to the public. I don't think, you know, it has as much relevance to the public as it does to the industry.
Right.
You know, whether you're on, you know, in the hotel marketing or the food marketing or a chef or a restaurateur, you know, that would find, you know, as you're going into your 2018 planning, you sort of want to get a sense of what are some of the, you know, key trends that may impact your business or, you know, or could also help you plan for your coming year. So I'd say primarily it's an industry-focused report, but because there's such a passion about food and wine and hotel stays, the public, you know, does seem to get a kick out of also wanting to be in the know.
Right. Now, what exactly is your company? Can you define your company?
Sure. So it's AF & Co., and it's a 12-year-old company that specializes in hospitality, marketing, and consulting. And under that umbrella, we do PR and marketing programs for a variety of restaurants, which could range from launches to ongoing promotions and getting the word out, basically. It's basically putting butts in seats in any way. And then we have social media now falls under that, which was not here 12 years ago, so that's been a big change. And then we then also have a consulting group that does literally comes up with concepts for restaurants, works with troubled restaurants and hotels, you know, also concepts for hotels. We basically are consultants that go in and work with, I'd say primarily in this case, larger restaurant companies such as, you know, Cameron Mitchell restaurants, and then hotel chains that are looking to, you know, be innovative and creative and put new exciting restaurants into their spaces or to fix a restaurant that may not be working on the hotel side. It's the same thing. It's how do you, basically anything that will help them come up with a cohesive concept and then figure out how to really stand out. And then how that all comes down is once we have that done, then we go to branding, and then from branding we go to PR and marketing. So, you know, it's very cohesive in terms of the services that we offer. We also do, we specialize in producing very high-end culinary events. Primarily we do two big events each year for the James Beard Foundation in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And then we round it off with recruiting for very high-level positions for our clients in the hospitality space.
And, yeah. And this last group of services that you just described, for those, it's a client engagement, they pay.
Yeah, well, everything. Yeah, so basically once the client pays, we custom tailor. Once the client pays. Once we meet with them and we agree that we're moving on to, and we're going to work together, we custom tailor a program and then price it accordingly.
Got it.
Now, how do you handle conflict of interest? And it's, I mean, it's a well-defined client base. Mm-hmm. And yet, I mean, a lot of people would look askance at somebody taking on PR for, like, competing restaurants in the same city, for example.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, there's a certain – well, first of all, I have two different thoughts on that. One is I really do look at that, and if I do feel like there's a conflict, then, you know, if I have a current client that we're already working with, there, you know, obviously I do pass on that, you know, we have passed on many, you know, many accounts because we don't feel that it's appropriate to take something on. That said, if we're not custom creating programs that are specific to the hotel or the restaurant, and, you know, I'd be out of business if I was stealing ideas from myself to give to somebody else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of times we're creating unique programming and everybody is, you know, they are, even if they're in the same, let's say they're both Italian, they have, you know, they may have, they may both serve Italian food, but they may have very different approaches to what level they're at. Are they fine casual? Are they fine dining? Are they fast casual? So, you know, we look at everything. And then many times I will call the client and say, you know, I just want to let you know that this is going on. And if they absolutely have a reaction to it, then, you know, then we'll pass on it.
Okay.
But part of the fact that you've worked with a lot of clients already is where you got your expertise from in the first place, right?
Exactly. I'm old. I've been doing this for just about 30 years now.
Wow.
And even though, you know, I'm probably the most immature person in our whole office, I think working in this business definitely keeps you on your toes and keeps you young.
Now the first suggested question we ask you is the 2018 Food City of the Year. So why don't we get that one out of the way right now, and
okay.
we'll ask you why.
By the way, I should tell you that, you know, this report takes about a year to produce. We really do, we have a team of experts. We do a lot of vetting. we make sure that it's not something that we're just, you know, pulling out of our back pocket, that there's definitely a sense of, you know, validation here. And when we did all that, we had about five cities that really were trending, and then where we saw the most interesting explosion of really great food and concepts, and where trends were actually starting now and also being, you know, emulated in other markets, was, ready for it, Washington, D.C.
Right. Well, you're there, you right go. There. So I guess Los Angeles is the one that I see changing the most, really.
And that was our last year's Food City of the Year. So
okay.
Right on.
Yeah.
That was last year's Food City of the Year. And, you know, I'm very proud to
but
say DC, that.
But D.C., yeah, D.C. Yeah. was, yeah, because we lived there. And
There was nothing when we lived there.
It was all, if you wanted to eat, there were the sort of hotel kinds of food, or ethnic, and that was there was no new American or anything.
Yeah, or you went to the French market in Georgetown and bought lamb chops.
Yes, exactly. Well, what I think is really cool about Washington, D.C. is that there is that infusion of ethnicity because, you know, everybody who lives there and who works there. But, you know, Washington, D.C. was sort of known as the state, you know, the steakhouse. Sort of that was the mode, and, you know, obviously even the steakhouses there have really elevated themselves to a new level. We just opened a restaurant about there with our client Cameron Mitchell called Ocean Prime, and it's seafood first. So even the classic steakhouse has really they've pushed the limit in Washington, D.C. But the exciting thing about that city is there are these really interesting cocktail cultures big there. Yeah. The you know, the international food scene and what makes up New American is really, you know, really important there. And you know, and I think, you know, there's been a lot of eyes on Washington, D.C., as we all know. And I would say that, you know, when a political climate's a little volatile, there's nothing better than a great meal.
Even if your president only likes overcooked steak.
Exactly.
You know, Cameron Mitchell is certainly a phenomenon. My cousin's husband went to school with him. He's from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, he is the, you know, he is certainly a force in Columbus. But now, I mean, you know, basically, if you go to Columbus, everybody knows who Cameron Mitchell is because he employs a lot of people and he does these amazing concepts there. But now this Ocean Prime, you know, this wonderful seafood meets steakhouse concept that they've created. They're, you know, they've opened 14 of them all over the country, and it's sort of been his, you know, his expansion, you know, outside of Columbus.
Yeah. And, well, now he's opened, he opened a number of restaurants, including a seafood-driven one in
here's one right here.
In Pittsburgh.
It wasn't terribly successful.
No, it wasn't very good.
Oh, yeah, I don't know about that one, but there, he's got one in Philadelphia. There's one in L.A. You know, they're all over. We're proud, you know, our company's very proud to be working with them on their national PR program for all those Ocean Primes.
Okay, so you have here on my list, I have food trends, which I think are, it's hard picking these trends in a way, except in another way it's not, because you see the same thing over and over and over again, and, you know, after a while you can zero in on these. I mean, you go to the fancy food show, because I covered that for a number of years, and there's everything thrown at you there, but you do see trends popping up.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you can't ignore
them. And I would say this, like, you know, everything old is new again, and, you know, we have, you know, with Gen Z and the millennials coming up, I mean, things that, you know, were classic to us now are being reintroduced in, you know, really, you know, fun ways. But, you know, I think probably, because people, you know, when we announced that the dish of the year was chicken, I think there was definitely a lot of eye rolls, but when you really think about it, you know, the world has gone through a lot of transitions, and, you know, again, it's also like what restaurant companies and chefs do with these dishes. So this year and coming next year, we predict more rotisserie chicken spots, more chicken sandwich spots, more interesting uses of, you know, the wonderful bird, you know, and who would have thought that that would make it, just like pizza. Pizza was also something that, you know, we saw trending again. Now, granted, you know, these foods go through cycles, but
right.
because technology has introduced a faster way to cook pizza, and also there's this customization trend and this, I want to build my own, I want to customize, I want it my way. Pizza and flatbreads give you that opportunity to get really creative. So I think customization and this, the ability to craft your own experience has really driven a lot of the trends.
Well, you know, you have one here that says about the everything is rainbow thanks to Instagram. I just read that everything is black and white thanks to Instagram.
Well, it's interesting. I know. I would say there you have it. I mean, Instagram itself is you know, just this crazy, a phenomenon that's just sort of changed our world because everybody is taking pictures of everything. I would say that black and white does not work in restaurants because nobody wants to take, no chef, no restaurant would want their food photographed in black and white. So the idea of infusing as much color as possible, which, you know, leads to the riches that you have, you know, with produce and fruit and natural infusions, you know, farmers getting creative with, hybrids of cauliflower that's now purple and beets and all these wonderful colors that are also delicious but end up on the plate that make it, you know, much more Instagram worthy.
I see. And now you say here.
Is that what it is? You see, I used to shoot everything.
When I was a restaurant critic for a city magazine, it was my way of taking notes.
Yeah, exactly.
But now everybody doesn't, so I'm really loath to pull out a camera.
You were ahead of the time.
I get fed up with people at the next table.
I know, and actually, I wonder if that'll calm down a little bit because the first, 5 minutes, and then they're holding lights up, their phones because they're trying to get a good picture.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, restaurants now and hotels are being built for all those photo moments. It's not just in food; it's in decor, it's in the tile patterns, it's in the way the bathrooms look. Everything is now is basically an Instagrammable moment.
Yeah, they have a friend of mine who's a confectionery caterer has actual picture frames in so that when you, she has some interactive, whatever you call it, in one of her shops, she has this interactive confectionery thing, and she has the frames right there so that you can hold them up and take your photograph with you holding one of her manic milkshakes or whatever,
Yeah, yeah.
You remember one time we had to stay an extra day in London because our plane couldn't land coming in because it was snowing in Philadelphia, I think. So we went to a restaurant called Sketch London, where Pierre Gagnaire is nominally the chef.
Uh-huh.
And they had the most incredible bathrooms. I mean, I snuck into the ladies' room.
I would say the bathroom is the most underrated spot in the restaurant, and anybody who doesn't take it seriously is shame on you, because everybody makes one trip to the bathroom.
Yeah, Sydney.
In the bathroom, so doing really cool bathrooms and really not seeing them as an afterthought is really important. Also, I always say to my clients, it's a great opportunity to advertise what's going on in your restaurant because everybody makes one stop there.
Yeah.
So if you want to get people to know what's going on, put a poster in the bathroom.
Well, this Sydney Australia restaurant, instead of mirrors over the sinks in the ladies' room, they had windows looking out of it at the opera house.
It's so cool. At the Rainbow Room where I worked, the bathrooms were on the 65th floor, and when you were standing at the urinal, there was a sketch of windows that looked out over Central Park.
Oh, wow.
And I always said, on a clear day, you can pee forever.
You're obviously very good at client relations.
Yeah.
You know, this thing with the phones, though. Do you know the Waterside Inn in Bray, England?
I don't.
How many? I guess it's 3 Michelin stars, and I mean it's
3 Michelin
better
stars.
Than that.
3 Michelin stars for like 28 or 29 years.
But they just banned cameras, and boy, everybody on Twitter came down on them. Yeah, calling them old fashioned. Gordon Ramsay was raving mad about it because he said how old fashioned they were, and blah 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 blah.
Well, they are old fashioned. They're an old fashioned thing. The food is absolutely fabulous. the service is out of this world.
Yeah. So now,
and it sits on the River Thames, flowing gently by through leafy green grass.
With the ducks that you can also have in your for your entree. Anyhow, so we got some idea of this thing. Overall, would you agree that this health consciousness is the biggest thing that's hit food?
In some respects, there's two different things. Because I think vegetables and produce have really taken their. This is, it's been, coming and coming and coming. But now, I feel that the fruit that we hated growing up as kids now have become very much more mainstream. As a matter of fact, cauliflower, would probably be, our vegetable of the year right now. And you think about, how. Feeling that kids hated their vegetables, and the way the world lives right now is kids don't hate vegetables anymore, because they're better. First of all, they're not coming out of a can, and they're just better for you. But so I'd say that chefs and restaurants have gotten really creative with making vegetable entrees that are not just, the typical vegetable plate that we used to get we went to a restaurant. There's now cauliflower steaks and rotisserie cauliflower and, just really delicious and vegetables being substituted, for meat. Now, you could say that that's health conscious and, to some point it is. However, I always kid, I said, those vegetables are cooked in the same butter that, that sometimes. So, I think vegetables have just taken their place on a menu somewhat for the health benefit, but more because they're just interesting and delicious. They're seasonal. We're supporting our farmers and all that. So that said, I think, vegetables have sort of come into their own. The other side of that, though, is that there is a health consciousness, and so juicing and fresh juices and seasonality of ingredients and looking at, every opportunity in a hotel lobby, in a restaurant where you can introduce something that makes people feel better or just gives, does boost them or give them a perception. I mean, hotels are getting crazy. They're doing vitamin C infused showers now. They're doing
what?
They're doing lights that you can control for to simulate darkness because if you're busy traveling, you're having all of this is.
We've been in those hotels, and none of that light stuff therapy works.
Yeah, but they also have customized fitness programs now that you can program on your your iPads and. So I think there is this quest for health. On the restaurant side, it's sort of an interesting thing. This year has been so volatile. I think the overall theme of our trend report is, change is the new black.
That's
because,
true. Yeah.
If you have to, every day, whether it's a natural disaster, it's a horrible, our political climate, or just a horrible hate crime or whatever it is, our world is changing so quickly and there's a little instability with the world. And I think that this sense of well-being is something that people, they tend to go to restaurants for this community, and so restaurants that can really adapt and change quickly to, the changing needs of their guests will really succeed better this year. So I say, have a plan, but your plan should be also to be able to change your plan this year because, we just never know what's going to actually happen.
Here's a countervailing force, though. I was trying to get in edgeways for the last 2 or 3 minutes. We just got a shipment of highly specialized ice creams. The first one we started.
Oh, right.
The first one we started is mashed potatoes and gravy ice cream.
Yeah, is that from Paul Straw?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
That's so funny. They're one of our clients. We represent them in the Bay Area.
Oh, they're fabulous, by the way.
Yeah, and one of the fun trends that we have in the report about them is that the other thing too is this whole quest to keep our environment as pure as possible and not throw anything away. So one of our trends is called Let's Talk Trash.
Yes.
And it's basically how ugly fruit and fruit that would have normally been discarded, mm-hmm. or, you know, a piece of it would have been used, is now being, you know, completely utilized in there's months like Project Juice has Ugly Fruit Month, and Salt and Straw did a month that celebrated, you know, the not so popular fruits and vegetables that sometimes were ugly. You know, that got so they're very innovative, they're very creative, So that's exciting that you're eating the Thanksgiving flavor.
Exactly. This is funny. It goes back when I first met my husband, which was 1972, was it?
Yeah, 1972.
Anyhow, I said, you know, I love ice cream. I don't have a sweet tooth, but I love ice cream, except they don't ever make it in the flavors that I like eggplant. And sure enough, here we are this many years later.
you wanted green peppercorns more than anything else.
I wanted green peppercorns and chocolate cake, and nobody would make it. But now it's all switched around. Our taste, the whole population here and elsewhere in the world, I mean, the population's tastes have changed.
Without a question.
So next we'll be having cricket ice cream?
You never know. Well, because insects are trending, and I will tell you that, I think the funny thing about it is, like, you know, the culinary world right now, which I love, you know, and this is also the bartending world, it's sort of like, what can you put in a cocktail? What can you put in a dish?
Yes.
And how adventurous can you be? Now, granted, again, you know, you're looking at a fast casual to fine dining, and somewhere along the way, you know, some of those things get weeded out. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, you never really know. I mean, you know, who would have thought that vegetables that, you know, as kids we all hated would now be mainstream? So maybe in 20 years from now we'll all be chomping on, you know, ants and crickets grasshoppers and it'll all be okay.
Yeah, we have pickle juice popsicles. Who would have ever envisioned that?
Exactly. You know.
Now, I wanted to ask you something. Do you ever use indicators or suggestions from outside your operation, your organization?
Yes, we work with, first of all, we have a team of experts, so I'd say probably, those come from the world of wine, food, technology, fashion.
Really?
There's a company called Technomics that actually studies, literally studies the industry from an analytics point of view, and Rich was one of our experts this year, so we're always looking at the outside indicators and then sort of a combination of the research that we do and then the research that's being done that really does indicate what is going on in the industry right now.
Right. So that on your website you have the study for 2018. I mean,
right.
can people go on there and send you suggestions?
Absolutely. They can download it. They can, there's a way to email me from the website. They can also, now we have a very active Instagram, so they can look us up, with our Instagram handle, which is at ASNCO. That is actually spelled out, at and then ASANDCO. So, I'm always open to suggestions.
That's great. Well, I mean, I'm so glad I finally got to talk to you because I've enjoyed these reports for so long, and you seem right on top of everything.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, it's a very exciting, I love what we do, and I love, next year, I'll either be eating crow or maybe that'll be a trend, but, sometimes we miss, but a lot of times, the other thing too that's interesting about the trends is that a lot of them are already here. It's just what we're predicting is that they're going to become cultural. Like the tipping point happens, and then they versus a fad that may last for a few months and then go away. So that's how we really look at the trends.
Have you ever gotten something really wrong that you could share?
The potato board would probably hate me for saying this.
Go ahead.
But one year I cited the ingredient of the year as the potato, and then this whole carb, no carb movement started, and I definitely was like, wow, I didn't see that coming. The flip side was the year that we predicted that pie was the dish of the year, that went crazy, and Oprah sent me pies. Oprah Winfrey sent me her favorite pies because I had cited her favorite pie in the trend report. And then, so for about a week after the trend report launched, we were just getting pies from everybody.
Now, I'll share one of mine with you because it's only fair. I used to recommend investment strategy, and we were looking for high dividend yield on stocks and looking at stocks.
This is in the UK.
Yeah, looking at stocks in tea companies. And the choice of tea companies was like China, Pakistan, India, and Sri Lanka. So, well, Sri Lanka looked a lot more stable in those days than it does now. It was actually called Sierra Leone. So that's the one who recommended. Within 3 months, the Prime Minister was assassinated.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, it's so funny because you never really know what's going to happen. But you know, I'd say 99% of the time we're on board. Now, some of them may not be, like, you know, I'd say 50% of them really do become the cultural ones that, like, we're proud about and we say we called it. You know what I mean? This year, for instance, last year we predicted that cannabis was going to be, you know, really popular. And look what happened. I mean, it got voted into 4 new states. And
oh, sure.
You know, people are infusing it into oils and food and everything now. And, you know, I always say the world is going to be a lot happier place, you know, in about a year from now.
Yeah, but they do these cannabis tasting dinners, you know.
Yes. And, yeah, I've been to one, and I couldn't get out of bed for 24 hours. I would say that, you know, I think that'll always have its place. It's never going to. That would be a really hard thing to go mainstream because of the children.
Yeah. But what about, you know, the money to be made in it right now? There's a lot of money
crazy,
to be made.
Crazy.
Well, Andrew Freeman, you've been a delight to talk to.
Oh yeah.
Very knowledgeable. I'm sure a lot of ears have perked up during the time that you've been talking to us. And I can't wait to keep watching for what you're going to think of next.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. And everybody have a happy Thanksgiving and a happy New Year.
And yes, indeed. Thank you.
Okay. See you soon.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
We promise we'll try to sound a little better, a little more cheerful. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.